Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 13, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call on the Cayetano stun gun case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back our return guest, Professor Nelson Lund. He's the university professor at the George Mason University School of Law. He's going to give us opening remarks of about 5 to 8 minutes, and then we'll turn to the audience for questions. So please do be ready with those questions when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Professor Lund, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much. This case involved a young woman who bought a stun gun, which is similar to what is often referred to as a taser, to protect herself from a ex-boyfriend who was harassing her. She used it successfully to fend off an assault on him on one occasion. And sometime after that, she was stopped on suspicion of something, and the police asked her to open her purse, and she did so, and they found the stun gun in the purse and arrested her. She was convicted of violating a Massachusetts statute that forbade the possession of stun guns, tasers, and similar devices. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, which is the highest court in Massachusetts, upheld the conviction. The Supreme Court granted a petition for certiorari and vacated the decision below and remanded it to the court below. It was very short per curiam opinion from the Supreme Court and basically said, no, you can't thumb your nose at us. And they didn't use that terminology, of course. But what the court below had done was said, well, they didn't have stun guns at the time the Second Amendment was adopted, and this is a dangerous weapon, and so we're upholding the statute. And the court pointed out that this flew directly in the face of very clear language in the court's Heller decision, and it was unanimous. The court was just unwilling to tolerate a lower court completely disregarding what it had said very clearly. There was also a concurrence in the judgment by Thomas and Alito, which went over some of the same ground in more detail that the per curiam majority opinion had done, but emphasized that this complete ban on stun guns was itself in pretty clear violation of Heller, because it forbade the possession of these weapons, which are less dangerous than firearms. And of course, Heller had concluded that you have a right to possess a handgun. And the Thomas and Alito basically said, a fortiori, if you can have a handgun, you should be able to have a non-lethal weapon like a stun gun. Now, to see the significance of this case, I think we have to also think about two other earlier cases, both post-Heller cases, in which the court denied certiorari, and there were dissents from the denial by Thomas and Scalia. And in both of those dissents from the denial, Scalia and Thomas emphasized that the lower courts were trying to evade Heller, and the court should grant cert in one of these cases to straighten this out. Now, I think what these cases and other cases in which we don't have dissents from denial show is that the Heller opinion left the lower courts with a lot of room to refuse to go any one step farther than Heller itself had gone, and all Heller technically held was that law-abiding citizens have a right to possess some kind of handgun in their home for self-protection. lots of the lower courts have basically said we're not going to go any further than that without the Supreme Court telling us we have to. And Thomas, Scalia, and now Alito have objected to letting them get away with that kind of judicial behavior, but they are a very small minority on the court, and an even smaller minority now that Justice Scalia is gone. I want to say one more word about the Cayetano opinion itself, or the Cayetano decision itself. I think one reason that Thomas and Alito did not dissent from the decision is that the young woman who had the stun gun was arrested when she had it in public. She was carrying it in public. And the court has not ruled on whether there is any, the Supreme Court has not ruled yet on whether there's any right to carry any kind of weapon in public. It's one of the most important outstanding issues after Heller and McDonald. And this decision makes it clear, if it wasn't very clear already, because the court has denied certain several cases involving public carrying of arms, that a majority of the court, a large majority of the court, does not seem willing to take up that issue. So we don't know what's going to happen in the future, and obviously that's probably going to depend a lot on who gets to appoint Justice Scalia's replacement. So that's my introduction to the case, and Dean, I turn it back over to you.
Thank you very much. I mentioned questions from the audience. We're at that portion of the program. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement. They'll say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to ask. So once again, we're visiting with Professor Nelson Lund on the Cayetano case. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time for questions, if there are any. Before we check in with the audience, let me mention our next scheduled telephone conference call, Friday at 2 p.m. We'll be talking about religious liberties and the armed forces. But once again, today on Cayetano and the Second Amendment, probably more generally, if you have a question for Professor Lund, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me ask a question, Professor. Are there, if you know, many other similar laws? I mean, how I think these I'm given to understand that bans on the possession of stun guns are not rare, that so therefore this case might have some sweeping impacts. Do you know?
Well, they're not rare, but they're not common either. I think there's a handful of states now that still have these bans on the books, you know, half a dozen or maybe around that. There's at least one state in which it was declared unconstitutional. I think most of these laws were enacted pre-Heller, and they're just sitting on the books. This case, I don't think, will have much, if any, effect, because all the Supreme Court really told the Massachusetts court is you can't get away with upholding it on this kind of ridiculous reasoning that flies right in the face of our precedents. But it would be very easy for any court to write a different opinion coming to the same conclusion. And obviously Alito and Thomas would disagree, but the court hasn't said that you can't write a different opinion and come to the same conclusion.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We don't have any questions pending at this point. You mentioned, the majority opinion rebuking the Massachusetts Supreme Court, and you said they didn't quite use the words you used. I'm wondering how direct and how firm the court was in its language. You said it's a short opinion. I suppose you're saying it was very clear they were displeased with what the Massachusetts Supreme Court was trying to do here.
It was actually not so clear how displeased they were. It is very clear to anyone reading the per curiam opinion that the court below had thumbed its nose at the Supreme Court, but the language in the per curiam opinion is very mild. It just points out that every one of the rationales on which the court below relied conflicted with what the court had said in Heller. And it did not use strong language. It didn't seem so much like a rebuke as if it's a rebuke, it's about as mild a rebuke as you could possibly have in the way it's worded.
Right. We do have one question pending at this point, so we're going to go to that. If you have a question yourself, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, Professor Lund. David Tryon in Cleveland, Ohio. You mentioned that about the circuit courts, federal circuit courts around the country seem to still have some animosity towards the Second Amendment and seem to want to read the Heller decision as narrowly as possible. And so those are the cases that get most of the publicity and most of the play. And it seems to me that perhaps the better strategy would be to go to the state courts and assert the Second Amendment and Heller in state court cases and in states that might be have judiciaries more friendly to the Second Amendment. And on the other hand, for all I know, that's been done, or there may be some other procedural reasons not to do that. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, I don't kind of do political strategy or litigation strategy, but I think in theory that makes a lot of sense. But I think one obvious difficulty with that as a strategy is that the states in which the state courts are most likely to look favorably on the Second Amendment are the same states in which the legislatures don't pass outrageous laws that clearly violate the Second Amendment. So I think that's probably why we're not seeing litigators pursue the kind of strategy you're suggesting.
Good point.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Professor Lund, you mentioned the sort of judicial, I don't know if you'd say obstinacy or intransigence. Is there...
Yeah, I wouldn't quite use those words.
Okay.
Because I would say they're hostile to the Second Amendment, many of them. They don't want to see it expanded. And they're not willing to take the language in the Heller opinion that's favorable to the Second Amendment as seriously as they would if they themselves were not hostile to the Second Amendment. But I think the main responsibility lies on the Supreme Court to be more clear than it has been. This is not an uncommon phenomenon. We saw this with the Commerce Clause after Lopez, that the lower courts really wanted to be sure the Supreme Court was really serious about changing the direction of the Commerce Clause jurisprudence before they, you know, extended Lopez. And I think the same thing is going on here. And, you know, I certainly think the courts, the few circuit courts that have been more favorable to the Second Amendment are doing what I think they should do. But I'd be a little hesitant to call the other courts obstinate since the Supreme Court has declined to issue rulings that they really have to follow.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, so let's take another call.
You have the floor.
Good afternoon, Professor. This is Greg Bedell in Chicago, the land where the Second Amendment is only just arriving. Are you familiar with the Moore versus Madigan decision from the Seventh Circuit?
Yes.
Well, that is an issue. The concealed carry issue is something that's getting hashed out here in Illinois and Chicago in particular over the last 18 months, 2 years. Are you aware of any other decisions throughout the country that may be working their way up through the circuit court chain to present to the Supreme Court issues on the bounds of concealed carry? We're dealing here on a regular basis in Chicago with disqualifications of applicants for concealed carry licenses based upon a whole host of issues, ranging from things like misdemeanor domestic abuse arrests, not just convictions, but arrests through for lack of a better word than the precise word, being vague criteria for qualifications or disqualifications. So is there any guidance that we might be getting in the future on this particular issue?
Illinois is an interesting case, and I'm going to say a couple words about it, and you correct me if I'm wrong, because you may know more about it than I do. Illinois had a law that basically prohibited anyone from carrying a weapon in public, whether concealed or openly, and it was the most drastic statewide law in the country. And it was struck down after Heller, in an opinion by Judge Posner, who actually hates the Heller decision, but thought it pretty clearly did not allow this kind of blanket ban on any form of carrying weapons in public. After that, as I understand it, the legislature passed a new statute that allowed for people to get licenses. And that statute was actually less restrictive on licensing than several other states. So Illinois went from being the most restrictive state in the country to being basically in the very large group of states that allows law-abiding citizens to get a permit to carry a concealed weapon in public. Now, what you just told me is not something I had heard about before, but it does reflect a potential problem in the future that we've already seen playing out in Washington, D.C., which was where the Heller case came from, and in Chicago, which is where the McDonald case came from. And the problem is that legislatures that are very hostile to gun rights and hostile to Heller and McDonald were, of course, going to be tempted to say, okay, the Supreme Court says you can have a gun, but we're going to make it as hard as possible for you to do so. And that kind of erecting various kinds of bureaucratic obstacles, high licensing fees, and all that kind of stuff that's being done is something that would never be tolerated with respect to other constitutional rights like the right of free speech. And it remains to be seen whether the Supreme Court is going to police that in any way. But even before we get to that, we have the question of those minor things. We have the question of whether the so-called may issue states
right.
are going to be allowed to get away with what they've been doing, which is to say, okay, you can get a license to carry a handgun in public, but you have to show that you're under some kind of fairly imminent threat. You just can't have it for protection against threats that you don't know about yet. And in those states that have those laws, a very, very tiny percentage of the population can ever get a license. Those statutes of post-Heller, those statutes have been upheld by several circuit courts. Certiorari was denied. The only case going the other way is the Ninth Circuit struck down one of these laws in California. But that case has now gone en banc, so we don't know yet what will happen in the Ninth Circuit, and we don't know that the Supreme Court will ever grant cert in one of these cases. There aren't many jurisdictions left, so if they don't grant cert in a case fairly soon, they will have just ended up having allowed all those statutes to remain on the books without ever even issuing a decision saying that they're okay.
We've
I'm not
got,
sure that responds entirely to your question, but
It did, thank you.
We've got one more question pending, then our lines are wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button if you'd like to join the conversation.
Hi, Professor. This is Zach Mayo from here in D.C. You answered part of my question at the end of the last one, so I was just wondering about two of sort of areas that the Supreme Court left somewhat undefined in Heller just because of the nature of that case. One, we just talked about sort of the types of restrictions that actually are permissible. They said, you know, some of these things like restrictions on felons having firearms are fine, but, you know, this is not an exhaustive list, so on and so forth. The other area is sort of the standard of review that will govern gun litigation going forward. Has any of the subsequent jurisprudence fleshed that out, either in McDonald or in this most recent case, or are both of those question marks still hanging in the air from Heller?
No, the Supreme Court has done nothing to clarify that in Heller itself. But let's go back to oral argument in Heller. At oral argument, Chief Justice Roberts said, well, you know, we're just getting into the Second Amendment stuff, and we're not going to try to clarify everything. And all the standard of review stuff that's come up in the First Amendment, that's all an accretion over many years, and we're not going to try to do that all at once today, are we? And sure enough, in Heller itself, they said, well, it can't be rational basis review. But beyond that, they said nothing. So most of the circuit courts have adopted a tiers of scrutiny approach. Many of them have applied it very poorly, in my opinion. But that's mostly what they've done. And for most regulations, they've used intermediate scrutiny, and they've applied intermediate scrutiny in a way that's very hard to distinguish from rational basis review. What the Supreme Court will say about all of this, if anything, remains to be seen. There's one interesting case in the D.C. Circuit. This was a follow-up to Heller after the D.C. government adopted a new set of restrictions, and they were challenged in court, and there was a whole bunch of them, and it went up to the D.C. Circuit. They applied intermediate scrutiny to most of the challenged provisions of the new D.C. law and upheld several of them and sent them back for further factual development on others to the district court. But Judge Kavanaugh wrote a separate opinion in which he had a reading of Heller that did not use the tiers of scrutiny approach, but rather a historical and textual approach. And I think that opinion by Judge Kavanaugh showed why some kind of tiers of scrutiny approach under that name or some other is going to have to be the one that's used for many, many kinds of gun regulations. Because when he tried to use a historical approach, it just didn't work very well because there's so little historical information about what anybody at the time of the framing or at the time the 14th Amendment was adopted thought about the proper scope of the Second Amendment. So I think most questions, not all, but most questions about the scope of the Second Amendment will end up being reviewed under some kind of tiers of scrutiny type approach. I think it's almost inevitable.
Thank you so much, Professor.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let's take another call.
Good afternoon. This is David Burge in Atlanta, Georgia. I have a question sort of from the other end of the spectrum. Here in Georgia, our legislature just passed a bill allowing carry firearms on college campuses, and the governor has not yet signed it. And there's sort of a great debate that somehow colleges are different, and even some Second Amendment proponents are sort of troubled by a bill that goes to that level. Is there any case law guidance that is out there on Second Amendment rights in that environment? This statute, if you're not familiar with it, would apply to college students that are 21 and over.
I do not know of any cases on that, except in my home state, the Commonwealth of Virginia, where these kinds of restrictions have been upheld and unfortunately forcing me to relinquish my Second Amendment rights every day when I go to work. So that's the only one I know of. There may be others. as far as case law. Some states have begun to move away from that. But as far as case law, the only one I know of is in our state courts here in the Commonwealth, and that did not go well for those of us who would like to exercise our Second Amendment rights when we're on the campus of a public university.
Let me make another call for questions. Our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. Professor, it might well be we've had our final question of the day.
Okay.
Let me give you a chance to express any final thoughts if you have one. And in doing that, I guess it's suggested here that we're in for the long haul. That is that maybe there's an analogy here with Roe v. Wade, where the Supreme Court has a ruling, makes a ruling, and then state legislatures and local governments, I guess, are exploring the boundaries in one law after another, and the court revisits the case not just for years but for decades. Is that an apt analogy, or?
Well, I think that might be a little bit optimistic. I think it's the court seems intent, and that began with Heller. I mean, the court seems intent on moving very slowly in this area, very slowly. Heller is full of unsupported dicta upholding various kinds of gun regulations to which they had no evidence or argument about what the Constitution really means. They just threw off these ipsy dixits. And that, that along with the court's behavior since Heller in denying cert on all kinds of really important issues that were left open by Heller, suggests that the court, at least a majority of the court, may have decided, well, we'll have a kind of symbolic decision here to show that the Second Amendment really does mean something, the way the Lopez case meant that there is some limit on the Commerce Clause, but may not be willing to go any further. And I think Justice Scalia's replacement could, once he's replaced, depending on who it is, if it's somebody who agrees with the four dissenters in Heller and McDonald, they could simply reduce Heller and McDonald to basically symbolic decisions that go no further, and that could just be the end of it in fairly short order.
Well, on that note, Professor, I think we'll adjourn the call. I want to thank you so much for your time here today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, learned a lot here myself, and I hope our audience did as well. I want to thank the audience for joining us, too, and a reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference calls Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about the armed forces and religious liberties in the armed forces. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.